A chilling scene opens Alfonso Cuarón's film Children of Men, cultural treasures preserved in a world facing extinction. But this dystopia isn't governed by a totalitarian dictator, it's something far more familiar. Internment camps operate alongside Starbucks, public spaces crumble while police forces thrive. The film's haunting sterility asks a question we're afraid to answer. What happens when a culture can no longer produce anything genuinely new? Since Mark Fisher's Capitalist Realism appeared in 2009, this question has only grown more urgent. We live in an age where revolution is easier to imagine in Marvel movies than in reality, where every act of rebellion is anticipated, packaged, and sold back to us before we can even articulate it. Fisher gave us language for this suffocating feeling, the sense that we're trapped in an economic and political system that has run out of ideas, but somehow convinced us there are no alternatives. Capitalism doesn't present itself as perfect. Instead, it whispers something far more insidious. Every alternative would be worse. This is capitalist realism. Not an ideology we consciously believe in, but the water we swim in, the air we breathe. It operates like a depressive's worldview, dismissing any hope as dangerous illusion. Philosophers Deleuze and Guattari described capitalism as infinitely plastic, like the shape-shifting alien in John Carpenter's The Thing, absorbing everything it touches without being governed by any transcendent principle. For young people today, capitalism seamlessly occupies the entire horizon of possibility. We've moved beyond mere incorporation of rebellious culture to something more sinister, pre-corporation. Our desires are formatted by capitalist culture before they can even form. Kurt Cobain embodied this tragic deadlock, knowing his every rebellious gesture was anticipated and commodified in advance. When hip-hop replaced rock's utopianism with a realistic embrace of late capitalism's brutal conditions, even that authenticity proved highly marketable. We don't just consume products anymore. We consume the very idea of resistance itself, watching films like Avatar critique evil corporations while munching popcorn sold by those same corporate chains. The rebellion has been scheduled, merchandised, and focus-grouped before it begins. Capitalism no longer suppresses anti-capitalism. It sells it. Hollywood portrays evil corporations as villains, letting us enjoy moral outrage while changing nothing. Philosopher Slavoj Žižek calls this cynical distance. We know the system is corrupt, we mock it online, yet we keep participating through every purchase and click. The film performs our anti-capitalism for us, providing catharsis without consequence. Since Live Aid in 1985, we've faced ideological blackmail. Caring individuals can solve global problems through ethical consumption and charity. No systemic change required. Bono's Product Red perfected this, shopping as salvation. The fantasy is intoxicating. Western consumerism didn't cause inequality. It can solve it through fair trade coffee, Teslas, and charitable shoes. We've replaced politics with consumer choices. The uncomfortable truth: real political agency requires acknowledging our complicity. Capitalism isn't an external oppressor. It's an abstract parasite depending on our participation, converting living time into dead labor. The Seattle WTO protests changed remarkably little. The most radical act isn't protesting the system, but refusing the comfortable illusion that symbolic resistance matters. This means building actual alternatives through collective organization and genuinely non-capitalist spaces. Environmental catastrophe exposes capitalism's core contradiction. Infinite growth on a finite planet is impossible. Climate issues saturate our culture, documentaries, corporate pledges, advertising, yet remain simulacra, too traumatic to truly assimilate. We buy carbon offsets while flying to Bali, acknowledging the crisis without changing behavior. Mental health reveals another systemic wound. Depression now affects millions across all demographics, yet capitalism treats it as individual pathology rather than systemic effect. The epidemic of anxiety, depression, and burnout stems from precarious employment, crushing debt, and competitive individualism that pits everyone against everyone. Many young people experience depressive hedonia, not an inability to feel pleasure, but an inability to do anything except pursue it. They retreat into hedonic lassitude, endless scrolling, gaming, distraction. Rising ADHD diagnoses and widespread attention difficulties may reflect systemic dysfunction rather than individual neural differences. Our collective inability to focus isn't personal failing. It's the logical outcome of a system requiring fragmented attention while destroying our capacity for concentration. Mental health conditions aren't merely medical issues. They're social symptoms demanding collective solutions. Michael Mann's film Heat perfectly captures post-Fordist work culture. Neil McCauley embodies the modern worker, anonymous, depthless, purely professional, with no territorial or familial attachments. His crew operates like shareholders, held together only by potential profit, knowing they're interchangeable and temporary. His life philosophy, don't let yourself get attached to anything you are not willing to walk out on in 30 seconds flat, has become the unofficial motto of contemporary employment. This mirrors what sociologist Richard Sennett examines, the affective impact of work reorganization summed up as no long term. Workers face an average of 12 job changes by age 38, each requiring new skills, relationships, and identities. These conditions of permanent instability create intolerable pressures, undermining the very values, obligation, trustworthiness, commitment that relationships require. Parents working irregular hours struggle to maintain consistent routines. Geographic mobility disrupts extended family networks. Hot desking, remote work, and the gig economy mean workers are perpetually connected, yet physically isolated. Ironically, this transformation was partly driven by workers' own desires to escape rigid Fordist routine, with capital co-opting this emancipatory impulse. The freedom to work from anywhere becomes the obligation to work everywhere. The promised flexibility becomes a burden, as workers must constantly reinvent themselves, maintain personal brands, and navigate unstable career paths while cycling between intense work and anxious unemployment. What happens when freedom from old constraints leads not to liberation, but to new, more insidious forms of control? We stand at a peculiar moment. The 2008 financial crisis didn't end capitalist realism. Bank bailouts massively reasserted the no alternative doctrine, but it did discredit neoliberalism's confident momentum. The system continues as undead defaults, zombie policies shambling forward without genuine belief. This creates an opening, however narrow. A revitalized politics must transform the taken-for-granted into the up-for-grabs. It should promise what neoliberalism failed to deliver: reduced bureaucracy, genuine worker autonomy, meaningful community. Mental health problems must be converted from medicalized individual conditions into collective antagonisms, captured discontent directed toward its true structural cause. Environmental disaster makes the case for rationing goods and resources, directly contradicting capitalism's growth imperative. Collective management of rationing is preferable to authoritarian imposition when it's too late. The pervasiveness of capitalist realism means even small alternative possibilities can have disproportionate effects. The tiniest event can tear the gray curtain. From a situation where nothing can happen, suddenly anything is possible again. Perhaps the first step is simply acknowledging that our current reality isn't as fixed, natural, or inevitable as we've been led to believe. The future didn't disappear, it was stolen. And what was stolen can be reclaimed. Not through individual consumer choices or symbolic protests, but through collective organization, mutual aid, and the patient construction of alternatives that demonstrate another world isn't just possible, it's necessary. The question isn't whether capitalism will end, but what will build in its place.